Our daughter, Jessie, loves playing detective.
A clue.
But since we discovered she has sensitive skin, we've been playing detective, too.
We thought the problem was our puppy.
But it was actually our old detergent.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So we switched to Tide Free and Gentle. Tide cleans better than the leading competitive free detergent, and it doesn't leave behind irritating residues.
Plus, Tide Free and Gentle has no dyes or perfumes, so it's gentle on her skin.
Case closed.
If it's got to be clean, it's got to be Tide Free and Gentle.
This is John Lyons, right now on WEEI.
Thank you for all that you've done for us. Thank you for all you've done for me. And thank you for the example and model that you've been for all of us on a daily basis for 20 years. You're unbelievable. Congratulations.
Back here on WEEI, I'm John Lyons. Second hour of the program, final hour of the program as well. We're going to take you all the way up till just after 6 o'clock. We have Red Sox pregame with Joe Weil at that time. Red Sox-Yankees tonight at Fenway Park, which is where I am, in the Ford Fenway Clubhouse studio. And we're going to have Nat Gordo, you may know him on Twitter as Boston Sports Gordo, joining us at 5:45 to talk some Red Sox leading into Red Sox pregame. But I want to continue our discussion of Tom Brady night, because for me, you know, lifelong Patriots fan, supporter in good and bad, which has mostly been good times the past 25 years, thank God, but lifelong Patriots fan, lifelong Brady and Belichick fan, that moment together was the most special part of the night for me. And there was a little piece of me that was worried. Is Belichick not going to come? Or is he just going to do a video message? Because there's still animosity there between him and Robert Kraft. No two ways about it. There is still animosity there. And I know they called it a mutual parting of the ways in January. Look, folks, if you watched that press conference when Belichick left, it didn't feel like a mutual parting of the ways to me. I know they said that, didn't really feel that way. And then there was the Seth Wickersham article, I think it was, on ESPN about Kraft telling the Falcons not to hire Bill. So it feels like there's some real deal animosity there. Something that maybe is even worth doing a philosophy project on if you're Bill Belichick. If you know, you know. Deep cut there. If you know, you know. But, Tom, did you get that?
I did get that.
Okay, good. Just checking. But point being, that was the one part, because, you know, we're in the night at Brady night, and it's an hour into the night. It's an hour and a half into the night. And I saw Steve Belichick in the background of a camera shot. So I'm like, okay, so he's here. So Bill probably is here. But still, it was an hour and a half in, and like he hasn't come out. I'm like, oh, no. If this guy doesn't come, this is brutal. And as great a night as it was, if he hadn't gone, that would have been the second biggest story of the night behind the actual. It might even been the biggest story of the night. So he ultimately comes. He gave a great speech, talked about. And I thought this was something that was I enjoyed of Belichick's speech, somebody that's been a football coach before. You talked about how Brady so seldom made negative plays. I thought that was huge, because that was a huge part of the Patriots' success for 20 years, is that they never really beat themselves. They never really screwed things up. And I was glad he highlighted that. I thought that was really cool in his speech. But what really, I think, stood out to me in the whole night, I would say arguably the biggest part of the entire, for me it was the biggest part of the night, was when Belichick came out and the ovation he got in the hug that he had for Brady. So this is what happened when Belichick was introduced.
Oh, man, last but not least, Foxborough.
What are we missing right now?
Welcome to the greatest head coach of all time, Bill Belichick!
Thank you. Love you, Patriot fans. And love Tom Brady. Thank you, Patriot Nation. Thank you. Tom, it's a lot better reception than we got out in L.A. Oh, thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you. Thanks so much. That's such a warm... Warm welcome. I can't tell you how much it means to me to come back here and See the great Patriot fans. Thank you.
That was the welcome that Bill Belichick got when he came back. And I got to say, as someone who was there, it was unbelievable. Like, and I'm not surprised he got the standing ovation, but just the energy in the crowd, the moment. Also, too, having Troy Brown and Deion Branch introduce him was cool. You know, Troy Brown, one of the ultimate Patriot players, was great at receiver, 101 catches in 2001, but also was willing to play defense, do all kinds of things. Deion Branch was a Super Bowl MVP, came back for a second stint, went to another Super Bowl. Great player, great teammate. So just to see those two guys introduce him, and that reception was just awesome. I mean, coming out to, and really, and if you were watching at home, you may not have been able to tell this, and obviously if you were just listening to the audio, you might not have been. Not only was it several minutes of a standing ovation, it was really essentially two separate standing ovations, right? Because he comes out, there's that huge ovation, the crowd goes nuts. And then after a couple minutes or so, people start to sit down, and you know, he says, it's so great to be here amongst, you know, it means so much to me to be back amongst Patriot fans. And at that point, the camera went to Brady. Brady stood back up. He started applauding, and then everyone that had sat down in the stadium, they stood back up. I think they might have even got louder. So it was really two separate standing ovations over the course of, it felt like 5 minutes, but it was several minutes long. It's just an awesome, awesome moment to see and for Bill. But for me, it was just an awesome moment to be a part of. And that moment of him coming out, and especially with the way things ended, you know, I was at his last game in January. And the biggest thing, and I talked about this in my post-game show in January, that there was a sense of finality in that game. Oh, okay, this might be it, and it might be over. And then, you know, a few days later, that Thursday morning, I think it was the 11th of January, you find out, hey, they're parting ways. They give that press conference that their parting ways doesn't feel that mutual. And it was just a really sad ending of an era, right? You knew it was going to end sometime, but it still ended, and it was sad. And for him to come back, first time back, and get that reception, and then the hug of Brady, because really, you know, there's a lot of reasons. And I know this might not be the most entertaining talk radio topic, but there's a lot of reasons they won six Super Bowls. It wasn't just Belichick or Brady. Which one, right? No, there was a lot of reasons why Hall of Fame or elite-level executives, assistant coaches, players at a bunch of different positions. I mean, look, Ty Law already in the Hall of Fame. Richard Seymour already in the Hall of Fame. Right? So Gronk will be in the Hall of Fame. Edelman has a case to be in the Hall of Fame. Dont'a Hightower probably does. Right, elite, and even if not Hall of Famers, like elite level players. Yeah, Darrell Revis was on the Patriots. I mean, the best, arguably the best or second best corner of all time, if you put Deion Sanders first, actually played here. Right, so that's the thing. But that being said, I mean, these two guys are the two pillars, and they were the two biggest reasons why. And you did notice, if you were there, that ovation for Belichick, I think was the biggest one of the night. I think when Brady said, I'm Tom Brady and I'm a Patriot, and we're going to get to a little bit of Brady's speech in a second. We're going to get to that line. That was probably a close second. Robert Kraft's ovation was not on the same level as those two. And I know he's worked really hard to make people think that he was just as important as those two. Doesn't feel like a lot of people believe that, at least the folks that were there. But I do want to get to, we have the sound. This is Brady kind of ending his speech saying that he'll always be a Patriot.
I am Tom Brady, and I am a Patriot. Thank you.
And you hear that ovation there for him. Again, I thought that was a close second in ovations compared to when Bill came out. And Zach Coe, our producer, you were there as well. What was your energy level and thought process when you saw Deion Branch and Troy Brown throw it to the stage and Belichick walked out?
Okay, so I'm glad you mentioned a little earlier that you were starting to get worried, like, oh my God, is he actually not going to be here?
Yeah, well, Zach, it's an hour in? Oh, no.
Yeah.
It's an hour and a half in? Uh-oh. It's an hour and 40 minutes in? You know, and if he didn't go, Zach, that's like, disastrous.
It would have been the biggest story coming out of that. The statue, the jersey retirement, the Moss ovation, it all would have been overshadowed by the fact that Belichick wasn't there. So obviously I went with my girlfriend, so we were sitting there and she's seeing all these guys being like, who's that? who's that? She's from Ohio. She has. She's not really an NFL guy. So
good date night for you, Zach.
Yeah, exactly. So shout out to her for coming with me. But the entire time I was like, where's Bill? Where's Bill? Like, is Bill seriously not going to be here? And then they bring out Deion Branch and Troy Brown. I'm like, all right, well, we're getting pretty close to the end here. Like, if this isn't him, like, there's a pretty realistic chance that he's just simply not here. And then when they finally announced him, it was like, oh, thank God. Like, it was more of a sigh of relief that he was there, that that wasn't going to dominate the storyline all day. And like you said, it kind of ended kind of sad at the end of the season, obviously. Terrible season. You have the number three pick. It felt like for the last 2 months of the year that this was going to be the end of Belichick. And the crowd reaction as he was walking off the field in that last game didn't really seem to be up to par with what Belichick deserves on his way out the door. So to have him come out, and obviously he didn't get as emotional as Moss did, but you could tell how much it meant to him just by him soaking it all in and letting the crowd do their thing. It was an awesome moment for me. I don't really remember the first three Super Bowls all that much. I was five when the last one happened. So to see him get his flowers, it was a really cool moment, and I was glad to be a part of it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. I was really glad to be a part of it. And I'm glad you brought up that it affected him, because that's something I noticed, too. And look, of course it affected him, right? And he said it was, you know, such a war, and how much he appreciated the warm welcome. But early in his speech, he was kind of, I don't want to use the word hesitant, but you could tell he was a little bit emotional after the ovation he had just got. And that ovation, too, I think it was a combination of two things. First and foremost, I think it was appreciation for everything he did, right? Six Super Bowls, best coach in the history of the game for 20 years, right? But I think it was also a bit of, hey, we still have your back after what happened. As in, you had a bad season, you got let go, then the Dynasty documentary comes out, and the first three episodes of the Dynasty documentary made Bill look really good, but then there were some moments that made him look really bad as the series went on. And some of them were fair, but some of them were not fair. And some of them were smear jobs, especially that Hernandez episode, sure. And the Butler thing, too. Like, some of them went too far. And again, some of them were fair, some of them went too far. And then the report comes out that Kraft prevented him from getting the Falcons job. And then he doesn't get a job at all. I think so. I think some of that ovation was, hey, Bill, you know, we still have your back. We're still there for you. We still appreciate everything that you've done. And I thought that was part of it, too. It's similar to the Moss one. Like when I mentioned earlier, okay, Moss didn't win a ring, but he got a little extra jolt from the crowd because, A, he was such an exciting player, but, B, hey, we still have your back. That it felt a little bit of that for Bill. Like, hey, we still have your back. We know. We get it. We know what you did. Forget about what people on the outside say. We know. We understand what you did here. And I think that's what, again, it was always going to be a big ovation just out of the appreciation factor, but I think there was a little extra there as a kind of we got your back thing. And Tom, other producer Tom Crisafulli here, you were not there. You had the pleasure of being here.
Yes,
so
I did.
Did you catch any of the ceremony? And if so, what did you think of it?
So I wasn't able to be at the ceremony. I caught stuff on, you know, Instagram, Twitter. I saw the Brady speech, I think, was the, for me, as you know, a guy literally named after Tom Brady, if that's not an exaggeration, 03 baby. I don't remember any of the first Dynasty. I wasn't alive for most of it. So the cool thing for, you know, the Brady toast, the roast, is that this is kind of how people my age, you know, 20 years old and younger, they experience that first Dynasty, you know, through the documentaries and things. So to see those older players come out, like you mentioned, Ty Law, Troy Brown, Deion Branch, you know, the Matt Litts of the world who you don't really remember, come out, you know, kind of connect the Dynasty as one, was super, super cool to see, you know, the OG Dynasty people or players get along really well with the newer guys like Edelman, Gronk, Dola, I thought was super special as well. But that Brady speech, you know, football's hard. I'm a guy who never played football, but you can take aspects of that speech and, you know, put it into your life regardless of what you do.
Anything.
So I think that speech, you know, was a perfect, I'm trying to think of the right word, you know, encapsulates everything about Tom Brady.
And I agree with you. And as someone that did play football and coach football, I thought it was a perfect representation of what football is and why it's a great thing. But I thought it was just a great speech, too. And I thought that moment, to me, the line that stood out, and it's already one of my favorite quotes of all time, nothing significant in life is accomplished as an individual. I mean, what a line. And it's so true. And that's something, too. And he made a point in the speech to mention, you know, let me be clear, there's no other coach I'd rather play for than Bill Belichick. It wasn't me, it wasn't him, it was us, which I thought was awesome. And I know he said things like that before, Bill said things like that before, but to say it that clearly, I thought was great, because that's been such an annoying topic in New England for, like, the last 8 years. Oh, is it Brady or Bill? It's, oh, made me sick. And even if you want to say one of them is a little more responsible than the other, I'll give you that. But, like, to say it was just one or the other, I think is stupid. And so for him to say that was cool. But, the, you know, nothing in life and significant in life is accomplished as an individual. What a line. And what a just great, great speech from Brady. Really enjoyed it start to finish. Just a tremendous evening at Gillette Stadium. Hats off to the Patriots for throwing such an awesome event to celebrate the career of Tom Brady. And really the dynasty as a whole, right? That wasn't just a Brady celebration, although that was, you know, 95% of it. It was also a celebration of all the dynasty, which was just awesome to see. Coming up, I'm going to circle back a little bit on the Celtics, because they do have Game 5 of the NBA Finals tomorrow night. We also are going to hear from Nat Gordo at 5:45, talk some Red Sox before Red Sox-Yankees tonight. But first, it's time to trend with Zach Coe.
Now, here's what's trending on WEEI.
The Red Sox defeated the Yankees last night by a final score of 8-4 to even up the three-game set at Fenway Park at one game apiece. The rubber match of that series will go down tonight on Sunday Night Baseball when Cutter Crawford takes the mound opposite Marcus Stroman. You can hear coverage of that game on the Shaw's and Star Market WEEI Red Sox Radio Network starting at 6:10 with Joe Weil on the MassMutual pregame show. Then Will Fleming and Joe Castiglione will have all the play-by-play action first pitch set for 7:10. Shaw's, perfecting the art of fresh. The Celtics will have their second shot at securing Banner 18 tomorrow night at the TD Garden in Game 5 of the NBA Finals. Tip-off from the Garden is set for 8:30 p.m. And make sure you tune in right here on WEEI after the game for John Lyons and KJ Carson with a special WEEI late night post game. The Oilers were able to stave off elimination with an 8-1 Game 4 victory over the Panthers. The Panthers will have another chance to clinch their first Stanley Cup in franchise history on Tuesday night back home in Sunrise. And the final round of the U.S. Open is underway. Last time I checked, Bryson DeChambeau led the way at 7-under with Rory McIlroy and Patrick Cantlay right behind him at 4-under. My name is Zach Coe. That's what's trending on WEEI and WEEI.com.
We're back to John Lyons on WEEI.
Back here on WEEI, John Lyons. And we just spent the last couple segments talking about Tom Brady night. We are going to talk Red Sox at 5:45 with Nat Gordo. You know him on Twitter as Boston Sports Gordo. Leading us to the end of the show, and then Red Sox pregame just after 6 o'clock. But I want to spend this segment here, our second to last one of the show, I guess, NBA Finals Game 5. And it's funny. In Boston, we're used to championships. Even the young guys like Tom, right? We're used to championships this century. When the Celtics are really good and they're championship level, there's an electricity in this city. It's tough to describe, but there's just an electricity in the city that's just awesome. And hopefully this is the start of a run where they're a championship level team every year for the next several years. But in order to do that, you got to get over the hump and you got to win the first one. And they had an opportunity Friday night and they got smoked. And we talked a lot in our first hour. And of course, if you missed any of the show, you can go back and find us on the Odyssey app. Or listen to any segments, rewind, fast forward any segments. But and if I look at game five, like I look at this as a game where the Celtics are better. Can they clean up the rebounding issues. Can they, you know, those corner threes and lobs we talked about in the first, can they find some solution for that? So I'm going to start with you, Tom. when you look at game, like, what are you going into game five? Now, this is an opportunity to win their 18th championship. And we talk about 18 banners. It would be the most championships in the NBA. Storied tradition. But it would be this group's first, right? Jrue Holiday won a championship, but it was with the Bucks. Sam Cassell did win one in Boston. He's an assistant coach now. But it would be this group as a whole, especially the leaders, Tatum, Brown, right? They're first. What are your expectations for them going into tomorrow night?
So I'm expecting a really big game from Jason Tatum. I always do this with the playoffs. I'm a Tatum guy over Brown. I just like his game more. And that's not a knock against Jaylen Brown. I love Jaylen Brown as well. But I think we've been due for a Tatum masterclass. Honestly, like this whole playoffs run, I feel. So I'm expecting a lot from Tatum. I think he has a big shooting night. I think he finally finds his stroke from behind the arc again, and he brings us home banner 18. But besides that, I know you were mentioning a lot about the rebounds and how you might want to see Cornett in there. I am the exact opposite, John. I think you should keep Luke Cornett as far away from the basketball court as humanly possible. I'm sure he's a great guy. He sounds like a great teammate from, you know, the stuff you see on Instagram and Twitter. He's just an awful defender in my eyes. He might help with the rebounding because he's 7 feet tall. But if Luka Doncic sees him in a pick and roll, you may as well just give them 2 free points. You saw what he did in the Western Conference Finals to Rudy Gobert, who's
a
defensive player of the year. Luke Cornett is nowhere near that level of defense. So I think they just kind of stay steady, steady their course. You have a better shooting night. Maybe Luka doesn't play defense. You put more effort into rebounding, and I think they have this one locked up. I've been saying game five since the series started, they'll take it. And I'm very partial to that because my birthday is tomorrow and I want them to win.
Oh, we need it then, of course.
Wait, it's my 21st at the bar. They have to win.
Oh. If it makes you feel any better, my dog's birthday is today. So, you know, you guys are right near each other. But it's an interesting point you bring up because, you know, I've felt, hey, I want Cornette for the rebounding. I'm talking 10 minutes, right? I'm not talking a lot. But Justin Turpin and I, who we did have on during the first hour, if you missed it, go back and listen. He's awesome. He had our live report from TD Garden practice today. He and I have talked about this multiple times, and he has said, no, keep Tillman in, keep Tillman in. And his reasoning, not dissimilar to yours, was, well, the Celtics like to switch on defense. Tillman can switch much better than Cornette. And I also think Cornette, like I thought he was really effective in that Cleveland series, especially without Porzingis. But then against the Pacers, he was completely overmatched. And I thought it was the speed of Indiana and how much they pushed the ball just constantly gave Luke Cornett issues. Now, Dallas, it's funny, I don't have the numbers in front of me for this, but just the eye test, it looks like they pushed the ball more than Cleveland, not quite as much as Indiana, so maybe he could find some sort of fit there. But I would agree with you, right? This dude gets switched on Luka Doncic. Luka's probably shooting 75% in those situations. But, again, to lose that poorly in the rebounding battle, maybe that's an adjustment. I'm talking 8 minutes, 10 minutes. He plays more than that. It's a problem. But again, Justin Turpin agrees with you. He's more of a keep Tillman in guy.
So I think the big thing, if you look at the Cavs series and the Pacers series, is that the Cavs would have what I'd say is more traditional style big, and he's also a little bit shorter in Evan Mobley, and he's a lot. He's got a skinnier frame than Miles Turner, which is why I think he saw a little bit more success in that series.
Sure.
However, the Pacers definitely play the fastest in the league. There's no doubt about that.
Yep.
The Mavs want to move in that half-court offense because, like you said, it gets them not their half-court. They want to push the break because it gets those corner threes open. They don't have to worry about the lobs, things like that. They can play a more free-flowing style of basketball, which I think really benefits Luka Doncic because he's just that type of player on the offensive end. And then, you know, he's not running those 24-second offensive possessions. He can kind of coast on defense. However, I just think the best case scenario, you keep Luke Cornett on the bench unless it gets really, really bad on the defensive rebounding where you need a rebound. Horford's gas, Tillman's not getting it done, or he's having a bad night. Then you put Cornett in there. But if I see one Cornett contest in game five, John, I'm going to throw something.
We got one in game four. Did you see near the end when he was in there in the fourth?
I turned it off by then. I started playing GTA.
And before I go any, because I do want to get to your Tatum point in a second, but Zach, I want to throw the same thing to you. I mean, when you look at game five here, opportunity for banner 18, but this group's first, right? So that's a big difference, right? 18 banners is cool. It's the best in the NBA history, but this group hasn't won the 17 first ones, you know, the first 17 together. This would be their first. So what are you thinking going into tomorrow night for the Celtics?
Yeah, I mean, I know for really the entirety of the season, they've been talking about we've learned so much, we've grown so much, we're trying to stay present in the moment. And then throughout the playoff run and then into the finals, they're saying we needed to go through that 2022 finals loss in order to understand what it takes to win. And then in their first chance to take that loss and learn from it and say, here's how we changed and we're going to come out and we're going to win, they lose by the third largest margin of defeat in NBA Finals history. So I know Tom mentioned it, but we're really waiting for that signature Jason Tatum moment. Last year he had Game 7 against Philly where he drops 50, and we really haven't had that at all this postseason. So I really would like to see him step up and take over a game and say, I'm the new face of the NBA. We just won Banner 18, and you all have no other choice but to respect me. Not dissimilar to the David Price, I hold all the cards now from the 2018 Red Sox run.
Yeah, and if like what I would love for them to get out of Tatum tomorrow night is what they got in games 3 and 4 against Cleveland. You go back to the second round, right? Celtics lose game 2. Game 3 and game 4, he scored 33 points in each game. 13 rebounds in Game 3, 11 rebounds in Game 4, but he had 6 assists in Game 3, 5 in Game 4. So he did everything really well, and he shot well too, right? He was 44% shooter both those nights. Didn't shoot the 3 that well. But I think if they get that 33-point, you know, 9 or 10 rebound, 5 or 6 assist game, then they're in great shape to win. Like, I think that's the night for them to get out of Tatum. And the 3-point stuff is weird, right? Like, this is the last 8 games for the Celtics, so 4 against Indiana, 4 against Dallas. This is what Tatum has shot from 3, starting with game 1 in Indiana. 25%, 14%, 50%, 27%, then going to the NBA Finals, 43%, 14%, 30%, 25%. So really, in the last 8 games, we're looking at 2 games that he shot well from 3, and then 6 games where he's been terrible from 3. So I think he, at some point, he's going to start shooting better, right? But I think what's made a difference, especially in the Celtics' 3 wins in the NBA Finals, what Tatum has done beyond the 3, right? Because he hasn't been shooting well from 3. He shot okay from the field in Game 1, 6 of 16 overall. He shot 42% in Game 3, not bad. He did have 31 points in Game 3, right? So, again, was great from the field, or much better. But you look at the other numbers, okay, in these games. Like game 1, 11 rebounds, 5 assists. Game 2, 9 rebounds, 12 assists. He was 1 rebound away from a triple-double. Game 3, 6 rebounds, 5 assists. So he's doing all these other things, and he's kept the turnover numbers mostly low. Like game 1 against Dallas, he had 6 turnovers, but then he had 3, 2, and 3. So he's kept the turnover numbers low, which is good, but it's all these other things. So I think if he can combine an improved shooting night with all these other things, then he's going to be the best player on the floor, and I think the Celtics are going to win. If not, then they're going to need a big night from whether it's Derek White or Al Horford. Remember, I think it was game 3 against Indiana. Al Horford hit 7 threes. Like, he's not going to hit 7 threes, but can he hit 4? Then again, that's a night that you get a night like that. Like, if Tatum gives you 30 and does all those other things, and a guy like whether it's Horford or White gives you 4 threes, then I think you're in business. Like, that to me is a winning formula right there. Now, I would say, let's say we get a good night from Tatum in game 5 and they win. I mean, is he, and I'll start with you, Tom, is he your finals MVP? Is it Jaylen Brown? I mean, through 2 games, I thought it was Jrue Holiday. But, I mean, where are you? Are you looking at finals MVP right now? Is it, or do you, it's tough for me to even find one person to look at right now.
So I was actually about to ask you the exact same question, John, if you had thought about it. Personally, I don't really care that much who gets it, because for me, I want to see my first Celtics championship. They're my favorite Boston sports team. It's the team I'm...
So just get it done.
Yes, just get it done.
Just get it.
However, no one has really stood out too much this series. You could obviously say Jaylen's played maybe the best statistically. However, if Tatum has, you know, 30-point triple-double, I think you have to give it to Tatum. Just because of what he does that doesn't pop up on the stat sheet, I will die on the hill that Tatum does so much more than you see on the stat sheet, just because of how other teams prepared to defend against Jason Tatum. You saw it clear as day in game one against the Dallas Mavericks. They were triple teaming him the second he took two steps into the paint. And that, you know, that allows him to kick out, move the ball around, create open shots, get those hockey assists is what you would call it. So I think they're pretty neck and neck. Some people think just because of the points, Brown's ahead. I think you have to give it to Tatum. At the end of the day, he's the best player on the best team in the world. I think that deserves final MVP, as long as he puts up a decent showing in game five.
Yeah, because they're averaging almost the like point numbers. Like Brown's averaging 21 points a game in the finals. Tatum's averaging 20. Right, Tatum's averaging just under 8 rebounds and 6 assists. Brown is at 5 rebounds, 5 assists. So Tatum's got the edge in a lot of those other things that you talked about. And I really think if they close it out, whether it's Game 5 or Game 6, of course, if it's Game 6, I don't know what I'd do. I might rather have you walk around in the studio and just hit me right in the face than have to deal with Game 6. But I almost think whichever one has a better closeout game, whether it's Game 5 or Game 6, because these numbers are so close, and I think the impact has been so similar because Tatum has done all these other great passing, especially game two. He was tremendous. Great rebounding. But then Brown has done a great job defending Luka. He's done an excellent job defending Kyrie, especially in the two home games. Like, so he's done these other things. They both have been doing these other things. So I almost think that they're at the point where, and who knows, like what if Jrue Holiday, they close it out and Jrue Holiday has like 28 points again or 30 points. Like that could be maybe consideration for, and I know he was really quiet offensively the other night, and he was pretty quiet in game three, but he was great in game two, big impact in game one. If he has a 30-point night to close it out in game five, like, do you give it to Jrue Holiday? And I think that speaks to the level of team basketball the Celtics have had, which has been great to see. Zach, I'll go to you. Any thoughts on a finals MVP so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys have both been pretty spot on. I think they're neck and neck right now. I just pulled up the odds, and Jaylen Brown's at minus 230 and Tatum's at plus 220, which I think is way off. So just from a sheer betting perspective, I think there's value on Tatum because you said it. I think whoever has the bigger clinching game, whether it be tomorrow or in game six or God forbid a game seven, is the one who's going to get it. I know Tom mentioned it, but I saw people all over NBA Twitter all week saying Tatum hasn't done anything. He's been terrible. He's been this. He's been that. And every time, like Tom said, he steps into the paint, he gets collapsed in on, which opens up corner threes, opens up different looks. So I do agree that there's a lot that he does that doesn't necessarily show up in either the point column or the stat sheet. But ultimately, I think that if Tatum has, say, 30 points or whatever, and Brown's at 25, you defer to the best player on the team, which is ultimately Tatum. So I think Tatum's probably going to show out tomorrow and then take home the MVP.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, what if they win tomorrow, but Tatum has, you know, 15 points, 4 assists, and, you know, 6 rebounds? Like, you know, helpful night helps you win, but then maybe it goes to Brown or someone else. You know, that to me is the part of it is a credit to the Celtics and the team basketball they've played, but also no one has really grabbed this series and said, I'm the star, which, again, I think has helped them get up 3-1 because they played a great team brand of basketball, and why I think this MVP discussion is going to come down to the wire, and it's very well could be whoever has the best closeout game. Now, we've talked a lot of Celtics and Patriots so far in this show, and I'm happy to do it. Game 5 of the finals, we just had Brady night. But I am at Fenway Park. We do have Red Sox-Yankees tonight. We are going to have Red Sox pregame coverage in about 25 minutes right here on this network. So I am going to spend the next segment talking Red Sox. And to help me do that, I'm going to have Nat Gordo on the line. You know him on Twitter as Boston Sports Gordo. He's going to talk everything Red Sox. Maybe we'll sneak in a Celtics question to him as well. But he's going to talk everything Red Sox coming up right after this break.
We're back to John Lyons on WEEI.
Back here on WEEI, I'm John Lyons. Final segment of the show, taking you up to Red Sox pregame. And to help me talk some Red Sox, I have Nat Gordo. You probably know him on Twitter as Boston Sports Gordo. He's joining us right now on the program. Nat, how are you?
Hey, what's going on, John? Good to be on with you.
Yeah, always a pleasure to have you on, man. And I want to start kind of simple, right, for those listening, because this spring, it's been heavy Celtics, right? They're in the NBA Finals. Patriots had the third pick, and they got Drake May. Bruins are in the playoffs. So maybe for those folks that weren't paying enough attention to the Red Sox or kind of had it on the back burner, what is this team in your eyes? Is this a playoff team? Is this a team? Because they're sitting right around 500 and they've been that way all year. Is this just a 500 team? Is it a playoff team? And what's your – give me a summation of the Red Sox so far in 2024.
Well, it's exactly what you said it is. It's a 500 team. And what is a 500 team? That's a team that is one really rough stretch away from falling out of the race, and it's one great stretch away from being right in the thick of things. At 500 right now, they're three out of a playoff spot. So what this team is one really good stretch away from getting into the thick of things. They've got guys getting healthy, and they've played good baseball against good teams as of late with the Phillies and Yankees here. But yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you said it is. It's a 500 team. They go above 500 a game. They go below 500 a game. They always end up leveling right back at that 500 mark. It's pretty crazy.
And Nat, you mentioned, you know, they could go on a really good run and be at the forefront of the race. They could go on a bad run and be out of it. Based on what you've watched this year, do you have a gut feeling on kind of one way or the other you think it might go?
Just looking at the schedule upcoming, I mean, you got the Jays a couple of times, you got the Reds, you got the Padres mixed in there. That'll take you through June. It really just, to me, it just feels like they're just going to end up leveling out around 500, and then the deadline could end up being that inflection point where if they add to the team, then maybe that gives them the mental jolt they need to make a real run at a postseason spot, and if they don't, they may just not get there. Maybe they sell off a couple of pieces, and that sends them teetering. We've seen it kind of the last couple of years where inactive deadlines have kind of sent that season down a spiral. I am a little bit nervous that with this ownership group and their lack of willingness to spend, we could be headed for that again. But again, like if the team proves that they're very much worthy of getting additions, I don't think they're going to be left high and dry. I don't think Craig Breslow is going to do that. But are they capable of proving that before those additions come? I'm just not sure. Well, obviously they're capable, but I just don't know if it's going to happen. They've got about a month and a half to prove it.
And you mentioned the schedule, too. Even into July, they got a series against the Marlins, a series against the A's. So some opportunities to stack some wins if they can develop some of that consistency. And I want to look at this pitching staff specifically. And I want to start with Tanner Houck. He's been great. I think the starting pitching has been better this year than at least myself. I anticipated than a lot. I mean, they already have as a staff 23 quality starts. All of last year, they had 47. So do you look at this as like guys like Tanner Houck have just improved and gotten better? Are you one of those, you know, Andrew Bailey people? You think he's made a big difference? I mean, what has been your thoughts on the improvement of the Red Sox pitching staff this year?
Well, I think you can look no further than guys like Andrew Bailey, new pitching infrastructure instituted by Craig Breslow. Justin Willard is in there as well. You've got guys taking steps forward, several of them. It's not just Tanner Houck. Cutter Crawford's in there. Garrett Whitlock looked great before he got hurt. So there's other guys doing it. You'll have to see if it can continue. I mean, the last month or so, it hasn't been as good as it was to start, but the fact of the matter is it's still significantly better than what a lot of people expected coming into the season, and it's been really impressive to see. The one guy I want to see take another step forward is Brian Baio. We just haven't seen it from him. So there is more room for this staff to grow. They've been good. I think it'll continue. I also think there's another level for it to get to. Whether it happens this year or if that development happens going into next year, I think we'll see it. But yeah, it's just a matter of when, in my opinion. I really do believe in the infrastructure that they've instituted out there.
Yeah, and some good news health-wise. Looks like Chris Martin, he had a rehab outing today. He should join the Red Sox in Toronto, at least according to the Boston Globe. So it'd be nice to get him back. You mentioned Brian Baio. This was a guy that, again, in the offseason, when we didn't think the pitching staff would be maybe as good as it is, we looked at him like, hey, he might have to carry this rotation. And it's kind of been the opposite. It's been guys like Houck that have really done the carrying. What do you think the issue has been with Baio? Do you think he's just, you know, having a rough year? Is there something mechanically there? You know, why have we seen him maybe not live up to what our expectations might have been?
You know, I was talking about this on the radio yesterday with Brad Foe, and it just, when you get an extension like that, fans have a tendency to just put the cart before the horse there. It's a 25-year-old kid, and, you know, you hear major league employees, coaches, staff talk about development all the time and talk about how it's not linear, and I really think we're getting that with Baio right now. They've fiddled around with his pitch mix you know, kind of since he came up, but especially this year, they've consistently worked on that slider. He talked about it after his most recent start, how his pitches are moving the way he wants them to. It's just been a matter of, you know, locating pitches that move that much as hard. And we've definitely seen it this year. So I think Bayo's going to get there. I do think that, fans are going to continue to be impatient just because he got paid and started opening day. So the team has told you that, he's that guy. And I think he will be that guy. But, yeah, I mean, as I said, development's not linear. We saw it with a guy like Tanner Houck, who had, you know, a couple of, good, solid years to start his career. ERAs in the threes, but you didn't really know if he was going to be able to make it through three times through the order, in and out of the bullpen. Then last year, you know, kind of up and down with injuries. ERA settles around in the fives. They thought about moving him to the bullpen again. He said no. And then this year, bam, develops that splitter, takes a giant leap forward, and here you've got that guy today. I think that leap, I don't know about that kind of leap, but I think a leap similar to that could happen with Bayo. Again, though, I really don't know when it's going to be. He's going to have to figure out how to command all of his pitches a lot better than he's done lately.
We're talking with Nat Gordo, co-host of the Play Tessie podcast. You may know him on Twitter as Boston Sports Gordo. Nat, I want to move to the lineup here. The Red Sox have had a lot of contributions from newer or younger players, whether it's Rafaela, whether it's Abreu, even Vaughn Grissom once he came back from injury. And you can expand this to defensively as well. But what have been your impressions of those guys, both in the lineup, in the field, so far this year?
Yeah, well, the thing that kind of as a whole has held the Red Sox back this year has been the offense and their consistency. But it's not been because guys are underperforming. And that was obviously a huge topic of discussion with Sam Kennedy talking about the team, quote unquote, underperforming. It's just been a bunch of guys who haven't had that success at the big league level before, but you've seen it lately, specifically with guys like David Hamilton and Emmanuel Valdez just at times carrying this team offensively. And, you know, as you said, defensively, Sedan Rafaela has been able to settle. Obviously, he can't play multiple positions at once, but you put him in the outfield, he settles that group down. They've got a really good defensive outfield with Duran out there as well, in the 95th percentile and outs above average. But Sedan moved to shortstop, at least temporarily, and settled down the infield defense that looked like it was about to collapse on them when Trevor Story went down. He's been such a huge help, and they've obviously been working with him on the bat. You've seen some good things lately. He's been hitting the ball a little bit harder, has a couple of multi-hit games recently, so he's moving along there. That's going to be a little bit more of a longer play. His value is going to come on the defensive end, whether you put him in the outfield and center or at shortstop. He has the ability to settle a group down, and he's done it at times this year. It's been good to see some of these young guys come up and contribute. I mean, they may not be guys who today can carry a team, but you're seeing those building blocks settle into place. And whether those guys turn into more than that, or whether some of the prospects down the line turn into anchors, or whether they sign anchors, you see pieces of the next playoff Red Sox team falling into place. Whether it happens this year remains to be seen. But they are building to something. You can see it happening.
And that kind of leads me into my next question, then. And you can include, if you want to include Casas in this and Bayo in this, like this young group of guys they have, which, you know, some fans may not even be familiar with all of them. But do you look at this as a core that can really grow into a contender? And I'm not saying that just these guys are going to win a World Series, but can they be the core of a team that with some additions can be a great team? Or is there still some kind of missing pieces there in your eyes?
No, I absolutely do think that these guys can grow into a real contender. And I think it can happen a lot quicker than people think, too, because people settle in and say this team has been a 500 give or take team ever since 2021. So for three straight seasons now. And yes, that's the case, but you've got evidence of stars budding. Rafi Devers is going to be a consistent star. He has been, and he will be for years to come. Tristan Casas, when he's back out there, people are going to remember just how great that guy is at the plate. You've got more coming through the pipeline. Some of the probably the biggest prospects that the Red Sox have brought up since Devers are all on the way and are expected to be up potentially, you know, 2025. Maybe one or two of them even make it up at the end of this year. But look for those guys in 2025. You start to look at how deep that lineup can get with all of those guys in there. Jaren Duran butting into an all-star himself has been such a huge development for this team. It really feels like they might just be that top of the rotation guy away. And whether that be someone they acquire in the offseason, there's plenty of free agent starters in the offseason. I look at Max Fried as a guy who, if the Red Sox would spend money, that's a left-handed top of the rotation guy that would fit in great with this group. But even if not, if Brian Bale can take that step forward and be a co-anchor with Houck, just it's Tanner Houck's development that has allowed fans to see just how good this group can be, because it always felt like they were a couple of frontline guys in the rotation away. Obviously, injuries, you know, Trevor Story going down for the year, Tristan Casas being out for extended time on the offense, like, that's held the group back this year. But if fully healthy, you've got Tanner Houck atop the rotation, you get another guy up there with him that can be a stopper like Tanner Houck has been this year, that's a good team. That's a good core that's budding. I know not a lot of people want to pay attention to it just because of the ownership stuff, and it's been frustrating, but the group is there. The core is coming. I really do believe in this group.
So last Red Sox question for you here, Nat, following up on that. Trade deadline, I know it's a while away, but just between now and then, do you expect the Red Sox to be buying, selling, standing pat? What are your early thoughts?
I think they're going to be a little bit more decisive than they have been the last couple of years, where they've kind of tried to straddle the line. Like, you saw them, they would trade Christian Vasquez, and that upset everybody, but then it gets you Willy Abreu and Emmanuel Valdez. But at the same time, you trade Vasquez, you're getting guys like Tommy Pham and Hosmer. And then last year, they didn't really do that much of anything, just bringing in Luis Urias. I think they're going to be a little bit more decisive this year. But to me, I don't know how much money ownership is going to be willing to add to the current payroll. I think if they win games and they want to add, I could see them trading Kenley Jansen to free up money and add that way. And if they don't make a big run before the trade deadline, I think they trade Kenley Jansen. I could see them trading Tyler O'Neill. They surely would look into trading Nick Pivetta if they don't want to extend him. There's a lot of guys expiring. Chris Martin as well, you mentioned, coming back soon. If he pitches well, he would be a tradable asset at the deadline. I lean more towards selling just because buying is going to be so difficult with an ownership group that seems so unwilling to add payroll. But, I mean, as I said before, it's a 500 team, man. Anything can happen between now and that deadline. You got a month and a half to prove it. If they prove it, Breslow's not going to sell if they're in a playoff spot, a game out of a playoff spot. He's not going to tear this team down if they're right there.
All right. He is Nat Gordo. You know him on Twitter as Boston Sports Gordo, co-host of the Play Tessie podcast. Nat, real quick, Celtics win tomorrow night?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Celtics in five.
All right. I love to hear it. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your insights.
Appreciate you having me on, man. Let's go. Let's go, C's.
All right. Yeah, let's go. And this is going to be my last radio few minutes here before the Celtics game tomorrow night. I will be on post-game tomorrow night with KJ Carson. Make sure you tune into that on WEEI. We'll be on as soon as the Celtics game ends. We will go until 1 a.m., but if they win, maybe we'll go a little bit past 1 a.m. if you're still into it, because I know I will be. Hopefully they will be bringing home Banner 18. And I appreciate, again, Nat Gordo coming on, sharing some insights about the Red Sox. I thought he brought up some great points. If you missed any of that, you missed any of the show at all, go on the Odyssey app, go on Twitter. You can find the whole show. You can find segments of the show. Feel free to tune in. Shout out to Zach Coe. Shout out to Tom Crisafulli. I had not one but two producers this evening. Usually I'm lucky enough to have one, but Tom and Zach, I had both of you guys. So we got a couple minutes here before we end the show. I want to ask both of you, we've talked about it, we've hit on it a little bit, but are we all three of us definitively looking at Celtics in five and winning tomorrow night? Zach, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think they're going to get the job done. I think the Tatum kind of challenged the crowd after game four that it was going to be the craziest in his 7 years here, so I think they're going to be juiced up, ready to go, and I think they're going to learn their lesson about playing around with their food once and for all and finally bring home Banner 18.
No more playing with food. It's done. Tom, I'll go to you.
Yeah, I got the Celtics in five for sure. I think that game four was just the Mavs trying not to get swept. Celtics will come out, take care of business. For my mental health, I can't take a game six or let alone a game seven. Wrap it up, make it easy. I want to go to parade this week.
Yeah, I'm going to have potentially two very different post games tomorrow night with KJ. If they win, I'm going to be freaking out. I'm going to be celebrating. I'm going to be having a blast on WEEI. If they lose, I am going to be pretty frustrated, but also I'm going to start to get nervous. I am, if it goes. And look, I know what happens. And hey, just last year, the Celtics got down 0-3, forced a game 7 and lost. I still think they're the better team regardless. And Dallas isn't going to win 4 in a row. But just human nature-wise, I'm going to start to get nervous if they don't win game 5. And I think they will win game 5. I think they're going to be better on the boards, which, again, they lost the rebounding battle by 21 in game 4. I don't think that's going to happen again. Also, yeah, I think they're going to shoot a lot better. They're not going to shoot 29% in the first half, right? It's just not going to happen again. And I think they're just going to be a little bit better defensively. Like Justin Turpin talked about it earlier on our segment, a little bit more connected. So I think they're going to be better. I got just about a minute left in the show here. Shout out, like I said, to Tom and Zach. Great job producing. Also want to give a couple personal shout outs here. Father's Day. I'm lucky enough to have the best dad in the world. So happy Father's Day to him. Happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. Happy wedding anniversary to my wife. So credit to her for being cool with me coming here to do radio on our anniversary. And of course, Zach and Tom, I'm a millennial, so I have to mention that it's also my dog's birthday. So happy birthday to my dog. So that about does it. You know, Tom, first time working together. Good working with you, man.
Hey, thank you. The pleasure is absolutely all.
We're back to John Lyons on WEEI.
Back here on WEEI, I'm John Lyons. Final segment of the show, taking you up to Red Sox pregame. And to help me talk some Red Sox, I have Nat Gordo. You probably know him on Twitter as Boston Sports Gordo. He's joining us right now on the program. Nat, how are you?
Hey, what's going on, John? Good to be on with you.
Yeah, always a pleasure to have you on, man. And I want to start kind of simple, right, for those listening, because this spring, it's been heavy Celtics, right? They're in the NBA Finals. Patriots had the third pick, and they got Drake May. Bruins are in the playoffs. So maybe for those folks that weren't paying enough attention to the Red Sox or kind of had it on the back burner, what is this team in your eyes? Is this a playoff team? Is this a team? Because they're sitting right around 500, and they've been that way all year. Is this just a 500 team? Is it a playoff team? And what's your – give me a summation of the Red Sox so far in 2024.
Well, it's exactly what you said it is. It's a 500 team. And what is a 500 team? That's a team that is one really rough stretch away from falling out of the race, and it's one great stretch away from being right in the thick of things. At 500 right now, they're three out of a playoff spot. So what this team is one really good stretch away from getting into the thick of things. They've got guys getting healthy, and they've played good baseball against good teams as of late with the Phillies and Yankees here. But yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you said it is. It's a 500 team. They go above 500 a game. They go below 500 a game. They always end up leveling right back at that 500 mark. It's pretty crazy.
And, Nat, you mentioned, you know, they could go on a really good run and be at the forefront of the race. They could go on a bad run and be out of it. Based on what you've watched this year, do you have a gut feeling on kind of one way or the other you think it might go?
Just looking at the schedule upcoming, I mean, you got the Jays a couple of times, you got the Reds, you got the Padres mixed in there. That'll take you through June. It really just, to me, it just feels like they're just going to end up leveling out around 500, and then the deadline could end up being that inflection point where if they add to the team, then maybe that gives them the mental jolt they need to make a real run at a postseason spot, and if they don't, they may just not get there. Maybe they sell off a couple of pieces, and that sends them teetering. We've seen it kind of the last couple of years where inactive deadlines have kind of sent that season down a spiral. I am a little bit nervous that with this ownership group and their lack of willingness to spend, we could be headed for that again. But again, like if the team proves that they're very much worthy of getting additions, I don't think they're going to be left high and dry. I don't think Craig Breslow is going to do that. But are they capable of proving that before those additions come? I'm just not sure. Well, obviously they're capable, but I just don't know if it's going to happen. They've got about a month and a half to prove it.
And you mentioned the schedule, too. Even into July, they got a series against the Marlins, a series against the A's. So some opportunities to stack some wins if they can develop some of that consistency. And I want to look at this pitching staff specifically. And I want to start with Tanner Houck. He's been great. I think the starting pitching has been better this year than at least myself. I anticipated than a lot. I mean, they already have as a staff 23 quality starts. All of last year, they had 47. So do you look at this as like guys like Tanner Houck have just improved and gotten better? Are you one of those, you know, Andrew Bailey people? You think he's made a big difference? I mean, what has been your thoughts on the improvement of the Red Sox pitching staff this year?
Well, I think you can look no further than guys like Andrew Bailey, new pitching infrastructure instituted by Craig Breslow. Justin Willard is in there as well. You've got guys taking steps forward, several of them. It's not just Tanner Houck. Cutter Crawford's in there. Garrett Whitlock looked great before he got hurt. So there's other guys doing it. You'll have to see if it can continue. I mean, the last month or so, it hasn't been as good as it was to start, but the fact of the matter is it's still significantly better than what a lot of people expected coming into the season. And it's been really impressive to see. The one guy I want to see take another step forward is Brian Bayo. We just haven't seen it from him. So there is more room for this staff to grow. They've been good. I think it'll continue. I also think there's another level for it to get to. Whether it happens this year or if that development happens going into next year, I think we'll see it. But yeah, it's just a matter of when, in my opinion. I really do believe in the infrastructure that they've instituted out there.
Yeah, and some good news health-wise. Looks like Chris Martin, he had a rehab outing today. He should join the Red Sox in Toronto, at least according to the Boston Globe. So it'd be nice to get him back. You mentioned Brian Bayo. This was a guy that, again, in the offseason, when we didn't think the pitching staff would be maybe as good as it is, we looked at him like, hey, he might have to carry this rotation. And it's kind of been the opposite. It's been guys like Houck that have really done the carrying. What do you think the issue has been with Bayo? Do you think he's just, you know, having a rough year? Is there something mechanically there? You know, why have we seen him maybe not live up to what our expectations might have been?
You know, I was talking about this on the radio yesterday with Brad Foe, and it just, when you get an extension like that, fans have a tendency to just put the cart before the horse there. It's a 25-year-old kid, and, you know, you hear major league employees, coaches, staff talk about development all the time and talk about how it's not linear, and I really think we're getting that with Bayo right now. They've fiddled around with his pitch mix, you know, kind of since he came up, but especially this year. They've consistently worked on that slider. He talked about it after his most recent start, how his pitches are moving the way he wants them to. It's just been a matter of, you know, locating pitches that move that much is hard, and we've definitely seen it this year. So I think Bayo's going to get there. I do think that fans are going to continue to be impatient just because he got paid and started opening day. So the team has told you that he's that guy, and I think he will be that guy. But, yeah, I mean, as I said, development's not linear. We saw it with a guy like Tanner Houck, who had, you know, a couple of good, solid years to start his career. ERA's in the threes, but you didn't really know if he was going to be able to make it through three times through the order, in and out of the bullpen. Then last year, you know, kind of up and down with injuries. ERA settles around in the fives. They thought about moving him to the bullpen again. He said no. And then this year, bam, develops that splitter, takes a giant leap forward, and here you've got that guy today. I think that leap, I don't know about that kind of leap, but I think a leap similar to that could happen with Bayo. Again, though, I really don't know when it's going to be. He's going to have to figure out how to command all of his pitches a lot better than he's done lately.
We're talking with Nat Gordo, co-host of the Play Tessie podcast. You may know him on Twitter as Boston Sports Gordo. Nat, I want to move to the lineup here. The Red Sox have had a lot of contributions from newer or younger players, whether it's Rafaela, whether it's Abreu, even Vaughn Grissom once he came back from injury. And you can expand this to defensively as well. But what have been your impressions of those guys, both in the lineup, in the field, so far this year?
Yeah, well, the thing that kind of as a whole has held the Red Sox back this year has been the offense and their consistency, but it's not been because guys are underperforming, and that was obviously a huge topic of discussion with Sam Kennedy talking about the team quote-unquote underperforming. It's just been a bunch of guys who haven't had that success at the big league level before, but you've seen it lately, specifically with guys like David Hamilton and Emmanuel Valdez just at times carrying this team offensively. And, you know, as you said, defensively, Cedan Rafaela has been able to settle. Obviously, he can't play multiple positions at once, but you put him in the outfield, he settles that group down. They've got a really good defensive outfield with Duran out there as well, in the 95th percentile and outs above average. But Cedan moved to shortstop, at least temporarily, and settled down the infield defense that looked like it was about to collapse on them when Trevor Story went down. He's been such a huge help, and they've obviously been working with him on the bat. You've seen some good things lately. He's been hitting the ball a little bit harder. Has a couple of multi-hit games recently, so he's moving along there. That's going to be a little bit more of a longer play. his value is going to come on the defensive end, whether you put him in the outfield and center or at shortstop. He has the ability to settle a group down, and he's done it at times this year. It's been good to see some of these young guys come up and contribute. I mean, they may not be guys who today can carry a team, but you're seeing those building blocks settle into place. And whether those guys turn into more than that, or whether some of the prospects down the line turn into anchors, or whether they sign anchors, you see pieces of the next playoff Red Sox team falling into place. Whether it happens this year remains to be seen, but they are building to something. You can see it happening.
And that kind of leads me into my next question, then. And you can include, if you want to include Casas in this and Bayo in this, like this young group of guys they have, which, you know, some fans may not even be familiar with all of them. But do you look at this as a core that can really grow into a contender? And I'm not saying that just these guys are going to win a World Series, but can they be the core of a team that with some additions can be a great team? Or is there still some kind of missing pieces there in your eyes?
No, I absolutely do think that these guys can grow into a real contender. And I think it can happen a lot quicker than people think, too, because people settle in and say this team has been a 500 give or take team ever since 2021, so for three straight seasons now. And yes, that's the case, but you've got evidence of stars budding. Rafi Devers is going to be a consistent star. He has been, and he will be for years to come. Tristan Casas, when he's back out there, people are going to remember just how great that guy is at the plate. You've got more coming through the pipeline. Some of the probably the biggest prospects that the Red Sox have brought up since Devers are all on the way and are expected to be up potentially, you know, 2025. Maybe one or two of them even make it up at the end of this year. But look for those guys in 2025. You start to look at how deep that lineup can get with all of those guys in there. Jaron Duran butting into an all-star himself has been such a huge development for this team. It really feels like they might just be that top of the rotation guy away. And whether that be someone they acquire in the offseason, there's plenty of free agent starters in the offseason. I look at Max Fried as a guy who, if the Red Sox would spend money, that's a left-handed top of the rotation guy that would fit in great with this group. But even if not, if Brian Bale can take that step forward and be a co-anchor with Houck, just it's Tanner Houck's development that has allowed fans to see just how good this group can be, because it always felt like they were a couple of frontline guys in the rotation away. Obviously, injuries, you know, Trevor Story going down for the year, Tristan Casas being out for extended time on the offense, like that's held the group back this year. But if fully healthy, you've got Tanner Houck atop the rotation. You get another guy up there with him that can be a stopper like Tanner Houck has been this year. That's a good team. That's a good core that's budding. I know not a lot of people want to pay attention to it just because of the ownership stuff, and it's been frustrating, but the group is there. The core is coming. I really do believe in this group.
So last Red Sox question for you here, Nat, following up on that. Trade deadline, I know it's a while away, but just between now and then, do you expect the Red Sox to be buying, selling, standing pat? What are your early thoughts?
I think they're going to be a little bit more decisive than they have been the last couple of years, where they've kind of tried to straddle the line. Like you saw them, they would trade Christian Vasquez and that upset everybody, but then it gets you Willier Abreu and Emmanuel Valdez. But at the same time, you trade Vasquez, you're getting guys like Tommy Pham and Hosmer. And then last year, they didn't really do that much of anything, just bringing in Luis Urias. I think they're going to be a little bit more decisive this year. But to me, I don't know how much money ownership is going to be willing to add to the current payroll. I think if they win games and they want to add, I could see them trading Kenley Jansen to free up money and add that way. And if they don't make a big run before the trade deadline, I think they trade Kenley Jansen. I could see them trading Tyler O'Neill. They surely would look into trading Nick Pivetta if they don't want to extend him. There's a lot of guys expiring. Chris Martin as well, you mentioned, coming back soon. If he pitches well, he would be a tradable asset at the deadline. I lean more towards selling just because buying is going to be so difficult with an ownership group that seems so unwilling to add payroll. But, I mean, as I said before, it's a 500 team, man. Anything can happen between now and that deadline. You got a month and a half to prove it. They prove it, Breslow's not going to sell if they're in a playoff spot, a game out of a playoff spot. He's not going to tear this team down if they're right there.
All right. He is Nat Gordo. You know him on Twitter as Boston Sports Gordo, co-host of the Play Tessie podcast. Nat, real quick, Celtics win tomorrow night?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Celtics in five.
All right. I love to hear it. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your insights.
Appreciate you having me on, man. Let's go. Let's go Seas.
All right. Yeah, let's go. And this is going to be my last radio few minutes here before the Celtics game tomorrow night. I will be on post game tomorrow night with KJ Carson. Make sure you tune into that on WEEI. We'll be on as soon as the Celtics game ends. We will go until 1 a.m., but if they win, maybe we'll go a little bit past 1 a.m. if you're still into it, because I know I will be. Hopefully they will be bringing home Banner 18. And I appreciate, again, Nat Gordo coming on, sharing some insights about the Red Sox. I thought he brought up some great points. If you missed any of that, you missed any of the show at all, go on the Odyssey app, go on Twitter. You can find the whole show. You can find segments of the show. Feel free to tune in. Shout out to Zach Coe. Shout out to Tom Crisafulli. I had not one but two producers this evening. Usually I'm lucky enough to have one, but Tom and Zach, I had both of you guys. So we got a couple minutes here before we end the show. I want to ask both of you. We've talked about it. We've hit on it a little bit. But are we all three of us definitively looking at Celtics in five and winning tomorrow night? Zach, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think they're going to get the job done. I think the Tatum kind of challenged the crowd after game four that it was going to be the craziest in his 7 years here. So I think they're going to be juiced up, ready to go. And I think they're going to learn their lesson about playing around with their food once and for all and finally bring home Banner 18.
No more playing with food. It's done. Tom, I'll go to you.
Yeah, I got the Celtics in five for sure. I think that game four was just the Mavs trying not to get swept. Celtics will come out, take care of business. For my mental health, I can't take a game six or let alone a game seven. Wrap it up. Make it easy. I want to go to parade this week.
Yeah, I'm going to have potentially two very different post games tomorrow night with KJ. If they win, I'm going to be freaking out. I'm going to be celebrating. I'm going to be having a blast on WEEI. If they lose, I am going to be pretty frustrated, but also I'm going to start to get nervous. I am. If it goes, and look, I know what happens. And hey, just last year, the Celtics got down 0-3. Forced a game seven and lost. I still think they're the better team regardless. And Dallas isn't going to win four in a row. But just human nature-wise, I'm going to start to get nervous if they don't win game five. And I think they will win game five. I think they're going to be better on the boards, which, again, they lost the rebounding battle by 21 in game four. I don't think that's going to happen again. Also, I think they're going to shoot a lot better. They're not going to shoot 29% in the first half, right? It's just not going to happen again. And I think they're just going to be a little bit better defensively, like Justin Turpin talked about it earlier on our segment, a little bit more connected. So I think they're going to be better. I got just about a minute left in the show here. Shout out, like I said, to Tom and Zach. Great job producing. Also want to give a couple personal shout outs here. Father's Day. I'm lucky enough to have the best dad in the world. So happy Father's Day to him. Happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. Happy wedding anniversary to my wife. So credit to her for being cool with me coming here to do radio on our anniversary. And of course, Zach and Tom, I'm a millennial, so I have to mention that it's also my dog's birthday. So happy birthday to my dog. So that about does it. You know, Tom, first time working together. Good working with you, man.
Hey, thank you. The pleasure is absolutely all mine. You really let me hop on the mic for the first time, which was super, super cool. I can't thank you enough.
Of course. And Zach, as always, pleasure working with you.
Yeah, John, us Abington guys got to stick together, so always a pleasure working with you.
Abington, Mass., a.k.a. the greatest place on God's green earth, right? We know it. You know it. I know it. We all know it. But, again, thank you all for listening. I'm John Lyons on WEEI. Red Sox coverage is coming right up with Joe Weil, on the pregame show, and we'll have the entire game here on WEEI, and I will be back tomorrow night for Celtics postgame, hopefully talking about Banner 18. Have a good one.